Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It was 4 days before Christmas, and I was getting the train from Dublin Euston to Portlaoise. My aunt would collect me at the station, just as she had done 3 weeks earlier. On that occasion, she had driven me to the hospital, where I held my grandmother's hand as she took her last breath. This time, we were heading to my granny's house to clear out her clothes. In the aftermath of loss, you're grateful for the busy work, the need to phone people and organise things. It provides distraction, but also camaraderie. I will never forget the strange warmth of sitting in the hospital immediately after my granny's death, my aunt and uncles so collectively focused on penning the perfect RIP.ie notice, aware that the woman lying in the bed just metres away would haunt them if they got a single relative's name wrong. When someone dies, you want to be around people who knew them in a way that you did. The word granny conjures up images of sweet elderly women who dole out treats and compliments. That was not Teresa Shortall. She was good for the sugar, true, but she was also the master of deniable insults. If she didn't like your trousers, she'd innocently ask if they were supposed to sit like that. If you arrived at the house with a hairdo she wasn't fond of, she'd say, "Who cut your hair?" As if this woman, who only left the county of Laois under duress, might know Natasha, who operates from a small salon off Grafton Street. I know from other people's experiences and from movies that clearing out a person's things after their death can be an overwhelming experience that takes days or weeks. If you're lucky enough to have lived to a good age, you're likely to have amassed a lot of possessions. But again, not Teresa Shortall. She was not a movie trope grandmother, and this wasn't a movie trope clear out. She was not into things. She had a kitchen free of gadgets, preferring a more MacGyver approach, whipping up an endless line of sumptuous meals, seemingly with no more than a saucepan and a single fork. Gifts were received like burdens. Where one might expect a thank you, they got an irritated sigh, and most were swiftly re-gifted. I benefited from this merciless attitude to possessions, often coming to visit on Stephen's Day and leaving again, decked out in the best of fashions, carefully chosen by my aunt and aunts-in-law. Twice I was sent home with my own lovingly selected present, with the blunt explanation of, "I don't want it." And I suppose we benefited again when, on her death, we were faced with a modest clear-out. As the only daughter, my aunt was heading up this endeavour. I was there in a junior capacity, maybe because I'm the eldest grandchild, or maybe because, like my aunt, I wanted an excuse to spend several hours talking and thinking about our favourite minimalist. We were there to do a job on the welcome list of busy work, but we were mainly there because we missed her, and we wanted to spend time with her. And we found her there in the wardrobes and drawers, all the versions of her that had existed. And it helped, I think, to remember that she was not the woman who had laid in this bed surrounded by the paraphernalia of the dying. She hadn't actually been that version for long. Mostly, she was the woman who went religiously between two practical fleece jumpers. Except when there was actual religion involved, then she put on good clothes, changing out of them again immediately after Mass. And the good clothes were very good. She had inherent style. We were sifting for keepsakes amongst the mounds destined for recycling. I was specifically looking for a pair of shoes that I'd coveted years ago and that my granny had said, with trademark lack of sentimentality, I could have when she was dead. She'd confirmed this bequest to my aunt. We couldn't find the shoes in question, so I took another pair. It was simpler than pointing out that she had almost certainly been buried in them. Sitting among the beautiful garments and the ones literally extracted from the back of a cupboard with a pole, we talked about Teresa. It felt ridiculous to miss her more at Christmas. In recent years, she'd stopped putting up a tree altogether. But that wasn't the version of my grandmother I remembered. It was the one who bought me pajamas every year as a child and who strung fairy lights encased in beautiful miniature carriages on a tree that admittedly was never a priority. It was the version who sent Christmas cards in the most elegant handwriting, and frankly, all the better if those cards retained pencil indents or other signs that they'd been repurposed from a previous year. It was the woman who sprinkled you with holy water from a battered 7-Up bottle when you headed off after the festive visit, who bent her head so you could kiss the crown goodbye, every year having to stoop a little lower. It was the woman who never said, "I love you," but let it be known all the same. In death, at least with one that isn't particularly cruel or untimely, the biggest comfort is that the circle of life continues. So this Christmas, as I chase after my own overexcited children, I will wear the shoes of a woman I adored and think how truly fortunate I was and still am.
It's coming on Christmas, we're cutting down trees, putting up reindeer, singing songs of joy and peace. I wish I had a river I could skate away on, but it don't snow.
Palestrina in Rome. One day, not too long ago, I was in a library in Rome, researching for my trilogy of novels inspired by Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty. The room had the great peacefulness of all places where old books are gathered, but after a few hours among the tomes, a headache was coming on, and I stepped out to get a breath of air and a coffee. Trastevere is my favorite neighborhood in Rome, the district my wife and I know best. Many scenes in my father's house and the ghosts of Rome are set there. Its labyrinth of narrow streets and shadowy alleys was used by Hugh O'Flaherty and his comrades to smuggle thousands of fugitives from the Nazis to safety. Such dark times seemed very distant as I crossed to the little cafe in the piazza through what felt like heavy drapes of sunlight. The day was so hot that you could feel the heat through the soles of your shoes. But the sweetness of Maytime jasmine seemed to bring its own honey-scented coolness. And the clusters of bougainvillea brought shade. Lovers strolled hand in hand. A busker was juggling teacups. Nearby, a fountain chuckled as it has for 1,000 years. Sun-baked tourists and dusty pilgrims lined up at the spout to fill their bottles. Rome's water is sweet and cold, brought in from the clay-blue Apennine Mountains visible in the distance from St. Peter's Square. A perfect scene in the piazza. Only one thing could improve it. From the high opened windows of the Church of St. Cecilia came the glorious sound of a choir. Everyone and everything in the square seemed to stop. Passers-by stood, the juggler stopped juggling, and even the lemon trees seemed to listen. Music makes connections like underground water flowing between those who hear it and those who make it. In music, we become tributaries of each other. To walk around Rome is to walk through the life of a man whose birth name few people know. Like many who lived on the Italian peninsula at that time, Giovanni Pierluigi acquired as a surname the name of his birthplace, a town in the Lazio region, 35 kilometers east of Rome on the Aniene River. It's always felt to me as though somehow that river flows through the ethereally gorgeous music written by the man named Palestrina. He likely began his musical training as a choir boy in Rome, then returned to the town of his birth as cathedral organist. But the pull of the eternal city was too strong to be resisted. Back to Rome he went, where at an early age he acquired the wonderful job title Maestro di Cappella at the Cappella Giulia in St. Peter's Basilica. He married young, became a father, was dismissed from his Vatican position when the Pope of the day decreed that all choir masters had to be ordained. Across town, he found work at the majestic basilicas of St. John Lateran and Santa Maria Maggiore, but it was to the Cappella Giulia that he returned in 1571, remaining there for the rest of his life. What a life in music it was. What gifts he gave the world. In addition to dozens of motets and madrigals, he wrote hymns, litanies, offertories, glorias, 5 sets of lamentations, and more than 100 settings of the Mass. No one had written music in quite the same before, but many would do so in the future. As the town of his birth gave a name to a man, Palestrina's name has come to be associated with a genre, full of counterpoint, rhythmic interplay, textural smoothness and grace, sparkling with flecks of loveliness and diamonds of light. This is music that flows like water on a boiling day, replenishing, refreshing, renewing. It's like listening to a Roman fountain translated into sound. Harmonies flowing into one another, like fountain water overflowing its bowls to fill the ones below and the ones below that, before being drawn back up again to the top where it started, for the circle to begin once again. Rome is a place I have come to love, not just for its beauty, but also for its ghosts. Where John Keats died, where Tosca sang of art, where Caravaggio painted on the walls of dark and lovely chapels, where the women and men of the World War II escape line, some of whose names we may never know, saved thousands from racism and fascism. I think of Palestrina, walking the ancient piazzas, or the back streets of Trastevere, or dreaming on the banks of Rome's most eternal presence, the Tiber, a river for which he wrote a love song, Alla Riva del Tebro, perhaps thinking of the river of his boyhood back at home. And I think of the great Hugh O'Flaherty, who treasured the sacred music to be heard in his adopted city, listening to the great Palestrina in the place they both loved. Music makes connections. It's an underground river. Through it, we are connected to other truths and other presences, and to absences becoming presences again. What a miracle that 500 years after his birth, we can hear Giovanni Pierluigi's feelings and emotions through the sounds he drew up from the deep. In the greatest of all instruments, the human voice, Palestrina comes home to every heart.
There I was, stretched out on the sofa last week, minding my own business, when I got a notification on my phone from Santa. My heart skipped a beat. Santa dot dot dot, to be precise. Santa emailing me on a wet Tuesday evening. I mean, it was five again. Surely to God, I thought he'd be busy in the run-up to the biggest night of his year. And then I'm thinking, what could he possibly want me to do? I mean, help him with making toys up in the North Pole, maybe? Or sit beside him on the sleigh and deliver the toys on Christmas Eve? My mind was racing. Because I haven't been in touch with Santa this year. I mean, I don't want a hippopotamus for Christmas. My two front teeth are fine, I think. All I want for Christmas is a big festive walk on a windy beach, like an ad, with a smiling family and laughing children and a golden retriever fetching sticks out of the sea. I don't know any golden retrievers, though. And if my family are listening, that is a joke or poetic license. But before I got a chance to reply, my eye was drawn to the subject line, which read, "Want to leave a lump sum for your loved ones?" What? The air began to leak out of my Christmas balloon. Leave a lump sum for my loved ones? What are you at, Santa? Aren't you reading letters, judging who's been good and who hasn't, and getting your toys all made? Have you moved into financial planning? Have you been hacked? Have I been hacked? And more importantly, does Santa have access to my health records? Am I dying? So when I clicked and opened the full notification, my heart sank again. Turned out it was from a bank. Hence the dot, dot, dot. Santander. I've never been a fan of the shopping centre, Santa, ever since a conversation I had on the radio on Christmas Eve one year with a man dressed in a Santa suit. I'd already clocked him having a crafty wee fag out the back of his grotto, but I mean, that's not a crime in itself. So when we were a few minutes late on the show and the producer pushed me into the igloo to talk to him, last item before the news, I said, "Well, Santa, you all set?" "What?" He wasn't quite on his game. "You all set for tonight?" "Yes," he replied, and I got a whiff of dark rum and one eye on the clock. I tried again. "So has everybody been good today, Santa?" "Oh, yes." Too many S's. And at this stage, I see the producer is holding a clock up and doing that fingers across the throat thing to say, "Wind this up before this guy says something we'll all regret." And I think, no, it's not a lost cause. It's Christmas Eve. Let's have one more go. The perfect question to end the show for the day that's in it. And what do you have to say to any boys or girls listening to the radio now, Santa? But he looks at me like he's in pain. And I can see under the beard his face is scrunched up. He either hasn't heard or hasn't understood the question. 20 seconds. I'm winking at him at this stage. "Boys and girls, Santa, for tonight, you know any advice for them?" And then he goes, "What way, like?" Oh, my God. "Christmas Eve, Santa, Christmas Eve, you know, bed early, leave something out, have a great Christmas. Anyway, thanks, Santa, thanks, Santa." And ho, ho, hopefully he didn't get that job ever again. So by the time our own kids arrived, I think I was so scarred by that experience that we never really bothered with Santa's grottos. We did go to a Santa's cabin up in the moorings, and then the annual Christmas nuclear arms race started. We live in County Down. First, we went to the famine village in Inishowen in Donegal, transformed for the season into a Santa's Wonderland, where I learned that in a very small world way, Raphael, one of Santa's chief elves, was actually from Cardona. What's the chances? Then the next year, that wasn't quite far enough away, and we went to a Santa experience in Sligo. 250-mile round trip. We never actually went to Lapland, but it felt like it was only the next field away. I did have the opportunity to make a cameo appearance as Santa Claus myself once. Not long after we'd moved into a new house, a neighbour, who I didn't really know, appeared at the door one night. I was upstairs, my wife answered the door, and I could hear him explaining about this big Santa suit that someone he knew used to wear, and this person used to come to their house for their kids. And halfway down the stairs, I could hear him saying, "And it's way too big for me." The wife said to me, "You'll be drowned in that big Santa suit, so you will." And as I skipped down the last of the steps, we locked eyes, and then he slowed away down. So I just thought, John. Now, I hope you'll agree, our neighbour had assumed so much here. I mean, I knew exactly where the next bit was going. But before I would even consider whether to be hugely insulted and tell him to stick his Santa suit up his chimney, or to just say, "Do you know what? Yeah, go on, happy Christmas," I decided I wasn't going to say anything. If he thought that I would fill his big fat Santa costume better than he would, he'd have to earn it by saying it all, every word, to the end of the sentence, out loud on my doorstep. So did I do it? What kind of heartless humbug do you think I am? Of course I did it. I did it once, and we never spoke of it again. So all I want for Christmas this year is that we're together with a nice dinner, a turkey that's been cooked with, well, that's been cooked, and definitely that family walk on the beach with the golden retriever fetching sticks out of a sparkling sea. If I could just get a land of a golden retriever.
Last Christmas, I gave you my heart. So go the words of the song. And in my case, it's true. On December 18th last year, the cardiothoracic surgeon took my beating heart in his hands and stopped it. That was just the start of my festive surprise, which included mince pies, leftover pudding, and a big bag of oranges, all brought to me in the hospital. One friend even brought me a gin and tonic. Given that there was a heart monitor beeping disapprovingly over my head, I decided it was probably not a good time to drink it. Heart surgery was not easy, but it was amazing and life-affirming. Here's my very simple near-death revelation. The best gift for your recovery is no question the kindness of others. I was surrounded by it at the Mater Public Hospital. The trick, of course, is to return the kindness. It's probably the only time it's polite to ever return a gift. And I've received quite a few Christmas clangers in my time. One year, I spotted my mother handing my brother a bottle of blue medicated shampoo to wrap. The one that looked and smelled like washing up liquid. When I discovered the next morning that this blue shampoo was indeed my brother's gift to me, while I was giving him an Airfix, I did the most dignified thing any self-respecting younger sibling would do under the circumstances. I snatched my present back and I legged it. Full disclosure, though, I haven't always had the best track record for gifts myself. The worst was a jewelry box made out of a cardboard egg carton, which I'd seen on Blue Peter. I thought I'd make it for my Auntie Monica for Christmas. Blue Peter loved egg cartons. They were extremely versatile. They turned them into plant pots, sailing boats, and elaborate Christmas lanterns, which were way too ambitious for me. But egg carton to jewelry box, that I could handle, if Monsieur Fabergé could see me now. I meticulously cover the egg carton with metallic purple paper, just like Janet Ellis had shown me on TV. And I cut a small piece of cardboard from a cereal box for the lid. Weeks later, when I took it out to wrap, it didn't look so great. It didn't look like a jewelry box. It looked like an egg carton covered in metallic purple wrapping paper. How did it come to this? How had I been tricked into giving my beloved aunt an egg box for Christmas? An empty egg box, that is. I mean, even a Kinder Surprise has a gift inside it. This is the aunt who'd given me one of my favorite Christmas presents ever, an orange nightlight that bathed me in warmth and safety and love during those dark nights of my 1980s childhood. And this is how I repay her? I didn't have a plan B. The magic of television wouldn't save me now. Auntie Monica just took the egg carton-shaped gift, looked a little puzzled, put it in her handbag, and never mentioned it again. Her silence was her gift to me. The greatest gifts also come from the most unexpected places. Many years later, when Auntie Monica was admitted to St. Vincent's Hospital in the weeks before Christmas, the hospital told my mother that we needed to get there as soon as possible to say our goodbyes. Minutes later, a Garda car pulled up outside my mother's house. The band Garda rolled down the window and said, "We heard you needed a lift to the hospital." What country in the world would send a police car to a house at midnight to drive a shell-shocked family to the hospital to say goodbye to their loved one? Well, this one, apparently. I was overwhelmed by their thoughtfulness. And on it went. Someone I hadn't seen in 30 years touched my shoulder at her wake, and I felt that awesome power of kindness yet again. Kindness is a magic elixir. It's a blue medicated shampoo. It's an orange nightlight. It's an actual orange. It's a contraband hospital G&T. It's even an empty egg carton. Last Christmas was a memorable one. The universe gave me a quintuple bypass, a cabbage five, an experience that I did not seek out, but I got a second chance. The surgeons, you could argue, did to me what I did to that egg box. Last Christmas, stitched and stapled back together with new arteries and pins instead of double-sided sticky tape, I hobbled around the ward looking lousy, but knowing I was repackaged with renewed purpose. I was, after all, learning to breathe and walk all over again. Would I be able to adapt to the world outside after all of this? This was no Christmas carol. It doesn't help to look too far ahead about what might happen or too far into the past about what I could have done differently. I was now more acutely aware of that strong, fragile heart that my surgeon so dutifully and carefully held in his hands. I adjusted my sad little hospital gown. If I had gotten this far, I could make it the rest of the way. I sat in that plastic chair draped in tinsel and took it all in. The blue sky, the friendly clouds, and the red-bricked buildings of Dublin's north inner city. It was a bit of a nightmare before Christmas, but you know what, Auntie Monica? It was one hell of a gift.
St. Nick's in the Liberties. I still go, Da. Every December, I take time out from the Lula parties and pack shops. Go back to your home turf and parish church. I cross Francis Street and hear your voice in me head. You'll always find freedom in the Liberties. And Christmas in St. Nick's. Inside the church is ruby, warm, and quiet. The icon of St. Nicholas of Myre looks very solemn, not a bit jolly. And yet, all I can do is smile. Smile as I watch small children eye up the big statue in red robes. Remember what you once told me, Da? Santa will look after all the presents, but it would do us no harm to kneel down and say a prayer while we're here. I bow my head and say a Hail Mary at the manger and light a candle in honor of our dear Saint Nicholas. The church choir rehearses music while I bask in candlelight and the music of long ago, just now, Christmas carols. I still go, Da. Every December, I take time out from the Lula parties and pack shops to find Christmas in St. Nick's. In the Liberties.
Christmas lights, Irish time. A very Merry Christmas to you, Ireland, and thank you for hosting me these many years, for feeding me brown bread, though my taste buds were formed on the agege bread of Lagos. Thank you, Ireland, for keeping faith in Christmas, even if at such time the rain falls 5 times a day, determined to dampen the celebrations. But Ireland, even when your weather offers the sideways rain, or the wind that doubles as a personal trainer and giver of constant grey skies, yet your lights appear everywhere. Trees are decorated indoors and outdoors, and strains of carols float out of shops. An immigrant like me can't help but feel impressed. Perhaps this is what resilience looks like, that in the midst of challenges, people are choosing joy. Christmas in Ireland has its beauty. It is quiet but brilliant if you look closely. I have learned that in this country, gestures matter more than speeches. A loaf of soda bread on a doorstep, a nod from a neighbor, or a driver slowing down to wave. Small kindnesses that somehow add up to a sense of belonging. Back in my home city of Lagos, Christmas arrives like a marching band. The streets come alive with music. Carolers sing as if the city's life depend on it, and the air saturates with frying oil and spicy jollof rice. In Lagos, colorful fabrics glow, headscarves tower like futuristic architecture, and shoes shine so bright you can almost see your reflection. In Lagos, everything is saying, "Christmas has come, oh, you must notice me." Here in Ireland, the magic of Christmas is different. It hides in scarves, in jumpers, in coats, and in gloves, which are not for show, but rather to survive the harsh weather amidst the celebration. Yet in those layers, one finds a kind of Irish poetry, a jumper knitted by someone who loves you, or a coat that has endured 10 winters, but still shields you from the wind. But there's joy, too, in discovering how much people will quietly welcome you, even when your accent is still negotiating itself around dinner tables, where both guests and host are still bluffing a little, pretending to understand one another. I remember my very first Christmas Eve with my wife in Hacker Street as we expect our first baby. It was quiet, imperfect, and unforgettable. I imagined the people from the nativity story. The wise men wandering between following the star and the fear of missing their way. I also thought about Mary, probably exhausted from labor, kept company by Joseph, who is probably lost in thought. Then the angels grumbling about night shifts. None of these people were perfect, yet every one of them belonged to the story of Christmas. Maybe that's the lesson both Ireland and Lagos are teaching me, that belonging isn't something you earn. Sometimes it's given freely, through a shared meal, or a wave across the street, or something warm spoken on a cold morning. It teaches that Christmas is light visiting dark places quietly, the way a morning comes, first softly, then all at once. It teaches about hope leaning close, about grace recognizing your face, and the quiet truth that even far from home, you can still be seen. So this morning, whether you're stirring gravy in the kitchen or walking a misty Dublin street, maybe you're wrapped in a blanket in the comfort of your home, or coming to the end of a night shift, I hope that Christmas meets you with comfort. May it be a celebration that whispers that you belong, that you matter, and that you are loved. From Lagos to Limerick, from Dublin to wherever you are, even if you're far from home like me, may the Christmas meet you with gentleness, with laughter, and the quiet kind of joy that lingers in the heart long after the carols have ended. Merry Christmas, my friends. My name is Chikere Ohoka.
You've been listening to Christmas Miscellany, featuring recordings from Sunday Miscellany Live at Christmas with the RTE Concert Orchestra, with leader Brona Cahill and conductor Gavin Maloney. The scripts were The Clear Out by Ethna Shortle, Palestrina in Rome was by Joseph O'Connor, All I Want for Christmas by John Toll, Unexpected Gifts by Quentin Fottrell. From a past Miscellany Live at the National Concert Hall, St. Nick's in the Liberties, a poem by Rachel Hegarty, and Christmas Light, Irish Time by Chicoray O'Hoka. The music was Joni Mitchell's River, arranged by Michael Keeney and performed by Lisa Lamb and the RTE Concert Orchestra, Palestrina's Alla Riva del Tebro, sung by the Palestrina Choir, directed by Blonad Murphy, Sparkling Sea, composed and performed by Naomi Burrell, featuring Matthew Burrell on clarinet. The arrangement for orchestra was also by Matthew Burrell. George Michael's Last Christmas, arranged by Andy O'Callaghan and sung by Lisa Lamb and with the RTE Concert Orchestra, conducted by Gavin Maloney. And from a past Miscellany Live at the Wexford Opera House, The Wexford Carol, arranged by Damien Gallagher and performed by Sarah Shine with the RTE Concert Orchestra, conducted by David Brophy. On sound were Gar Duffy and Damien Gavigan. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.